Committee on State Government, Innovation, and Veterans will come to order. Today is Wednesday, 23rd, 2011. We're going to move right along here real quick. I see the Commissioner Shelato is here. So the first item on the agenda is consideration of the appointment of Major General Larry Shelato as Commissioner of Veterans Affairs. So we'd ask General Shelato to come forward here. In January, Governor Dayton announced the appointment of retired Major General Larry Shelato to lead the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Major General Shelato had previously served as the Adjutant General of the Minnesota National Guard and is widely regarded as a strong and dynamic leader who is respected for his dedication to our nation's servicemen and women. Major General Shelato, we'd like to have you just spend a few minutes talking about your background, your accomplishments, and anything else you would like the committee to consider. And after you conclude, members will have the opportunity to ask you any questions. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Perry. My name is Larry Shelato. I am a native of Minnesota my entire life, except for 3 days when I was born in the hospital in Fargo, North Dakota. My father was a farmer in Clay County. He passed away when I was six. We have a family of six brothers and sisters. My mother never remarried. And we all graduated from higher education doing that. I graduated from Morehead State University in 1968. 12 days later, I was in the United States Army. I was anticipating a lot of other things, and the interview for the job said to check out the draft board to make sure you were okay. I went down there, and they said, if you're graduating in June, you'll get your notice in either April or May. At that time, I thought my whole life was turned upside down. Went through officer training program at Fort Benning, Georgia. I'm a certified parachutist. I'm a certified jungle expert. And in rewards for that, they sent me straight to Vietnam, where I served as an advisor to the Vietnamese Army for a year. My job consisted of myself and four NCOs. We lived right in the village in Vietnam. And we worked with, trained, supplied, provided medical assistance, et cetera, to them. I worked also with the Koreans, and the least contact I had in my year over there was with the American forces. Came back home, really kind of lost. I decided that I'd go back to school for a second degree, which I gained. It was a teaching degree, a profession I thought I would never go into. And I had to student teach. I student taught at Alexandria Technical College, then Technical Institute. They offered me a job, which I accepted, and my claim to fame there was in 31 years, I went from a student teacher to its president the last 9 years. Very proud of that. But then in 2003, also, I should say, concurrently then met my wife at Morehead State when I was going through that for a second time, and we dated, and while we were dating, a person that lived in the apartment building where she was at needed a young lieutenant because he was in the guard also. So he asked me to sign up, and I did because I had the weekends off and the summer off as a teacher. I joined the National Guard in 1972, and from a second lieutenant, I rose through the ranks to become the division commander of the 34th Infantry Red Bulls, and then concurrently, in fact, I hold the distinction of being both the division commander and the adjutant general for a year because the two leading candidates for the position, one was in Kosovo and the other one was in Bosnia. In the 7 years, we have deployed over 20,000 deployment orders. We have sent troops to over 33 different countries, and I used to say I was the number one manufacturer of veterans in the state of Minnesota. And it's, as you know, continuing as another group will be going forth, one to Afghanistan and one to Kuwait/Iraq. So that's it. I hold 4 degrees, 2 bachelors, a master's, and a doctorate through the University of Minnesota. As I say a lot of times to the veterans, I've been there, I've done that. So unless you have some specific questions, I'd be more than happy to answer those.
Thank you for that, Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. General Sciolto, my son-in-law had the privilege of serving under you in both Bosnia and in Iraq, and so he speaks very highly of you, and he was a Red Bull. I have a question, though, regarding the Hastings Vet Hospital and some of the disturbing things that happened down there when you were not commissioner or even commissioner-elect. Can we have some assurance that as we go forward that would could be revisited, and it appears that we may have a situation where maybe we left a soldier on the battlefield. I'm a little bit concerned about what happened to Chip Cox down there and would really kind of like to have some understanding that we could have a review of that. Is that possible?
That's not only possible, it was done yesterday. What had happened was I went there and I did a visit of Hastings. I'll be doing one with each of the homes throughout the state of Minnesota. But we had three sessions, first with the residents at Hastings, and there was an open forum, questions and answers and so forth, then with the staff, and then third with the management group, and then I did a tour of the facilities. So we're on top of that. We're fully aware of it, and I know the issues that you're relating to, and they are being addressed.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I'd like to make a note that there is a quorum present. Any other questions that we have?
Senator Gazelka. I had a constituent that brought that up, too, and so I'm hoping that information, what you find, comes back to the committee.
Senator, it will be done.
Thank you.
Senator Daley.
Commissioner, when can you commit to seeing all five of the homes? An approximate date that you can commit to getting out to see those?
Senator Perry, Senator Daley, we have it on the calendar. It's on the calendar. The issue is on again, off again as far as shifting of dates. But right now, and I think Gills and Yannis, we're pretty much having them all visited by the end of March.
Anything else?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Senator Wigger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Major General Sciolto, I just want to thank you for your service, your leadership, the prompt follow-up by your staff and questions that are asked, and wish you the best in your term.
Thank you.
Senator Daley.
Mr. Chair, I move that the committee recommend to the full Senate the confirmation of Major General Larry Sciolto as a Commissioner of Veterans Affairs.
Senator Daley moves that the committee recommend to the full Senate the confirmation of Major General Larry Sciolto as the Commissioner of Veterans Affairs. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails.
Thank
Commissioner,
you.
Commissioner, thank you, and we'll be sending this to the Senate floor with our recommendation.
And thank you for your service.
Thank you very much. The next item on the agenda is an overview from the Association of Minnesota Public Education Radio Stations. I want to thank them for coming back. We ran out of time, and I just felt that it was important that we give them the time that we have afforded others to give us an overview of their association. So with that, please introduce yourself, and we'll proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Barry Tilley, and I represent the Association of Minnesota Public Educational Radio Stations. It's an association of 12 independent stations located throughout Minnesota. We are basically all the larger public radio stations in Minnesota except Minnesota Public Radio. They are not a part of our association. I'm here to introduce to you our president, and Michelle Jansen from KBEM Jazz 88 in Minneapolis. Michelle.
Thank you, Barry. Chairman Perry, members of the committee, my name is Michelle Jansen. I am president of AMPRS and also station manager for KBEM Jazz 88 here in the Twin Cities. We won't be using the PowerPoint today, but you do have a handout that is pretty much the same report. We'd like to begin by thanking you for having us here today, and more importantly, we'd like to thank you for the funding which has allowed us to better serve the citizens of Minnesota. AMPRS, which provides diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, is made up of 12 independently community-based radio stations around Minnesota. We are not affiliated with, nor do we receive any funding from Minnesota Public Radio. Each AMPRS station is licensed to a college, school, or university, or licensed directly to the community it serves. The AMPRS stations include WTIP, serving Grand Marais, Grand Portage, and the Gunflint Trail, and is licensed directly to the community. KAXE serves the Grand Rapids, Bemidji, and Brainerd area, is also community licensed. KSRQ in Thief River Falls is licensed to Northland Community and Technical College. KUMD-FM covers the Duluth area and is affiliated with the University of Minnesota Duluth. KVSC-FM's broadcast signal covers the greater St. Cloud area and is licensed to St. Cloud State University. The four stations here in the Twin Cities include Jazz 88, licensed to the Minneapolis Public Schools, KUOM Radio K at the University of Minnesota, and KFAI and KMOJ, both community-licensed stations. In southern Minnesota, we have KMSU covering Mankato and Austin at the University, rather, Mankato State University, and KQAL at Winona State University. KUMM in Morris is licensed to the University of Minnesota Morris, but does not receive state funding because of its size. Because Minnesota Public Radio and the AMPRS stations are all public radio stations, understandably, there's a fair amount of confusion. The two serve very different audiences, have different needs, and operate in very different ways. The AMPRS stations are smaller community radio stations. Each station has between 2 and 14 employees on staff, with many of them relying heavily on volunteers. The AMPRS stations are not rebroadcasting or reprogramming, retransmitting programming from one main station. Each station is individually programmed to meet the needs of their community. The stations all have their own local management and board of directors to ensure they are truly serving the needs of their local community on a grassroots level. As a result, we have programs in 13 different languages, ranging from Ojibwe to Oromo, as well as local public affairs programming and diverse music. Each station also has significant educational programs ranging from formal broadcast classes to hands-on training for community volunteers. In your packet of information, you'll find background about AMPRS, information about how the stations use state funding, as well as letters of support. Chairman Perry, your invitation for today's meeting asked us to discuss our mission. AMPRS itself is an association designed to help support Minnesota's community radio stations, but state funds ultimately go directly to the stations. So you are probably more interested in the station's missions, and while we don't have time to present all 11, they really are quite similar. In general, the AMPRS stations exist to serve their communities. That includes providing timely and accurate reports of local and state events, including everything from severe weather and other emergencies to concerts, plays, high school and college sporting events. Some stations even broadcast city council and school board meetings. As I just mentioned, all stations have a very strong commitment to education, educating Minnesotans through news, public affairs, and other educational programming. It's also educating high school, college students, and members of the community through in-studio and classroom training about radio broadcasting and new media. How will we accomplish that mission? First of all, we remain entrenched in the local communities that we serve. All of the stations either have a board of directors or a community and programming advisory committee to ensure we're meeting the needs of the community. We continue to identify areas not served by traditional media and fill those voids, like KAXE's recent decision to add a weekly program in Ojibwe. We work closely with local emergency officials like WTIP did when the huge Ham Lake fire ripped through northern Minnesota. WTIP was the only source of daily information about evacuations and other updates from the Forest Service, DNR officials, and the Sheriff's Department. And we seek out additional partnerships like KVSC's with the Central Minnesota Audio Newspaper, where volunteers read daily and weekly newspapers to those unable to do so. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, you've asked us that we explain how our agency contributes to the improvement of Minnesota. I've already touched on some, like the fact that we provide emergency information, news and public affairs, as well as educational programs. Of course, we provide entertainment ranging from live and recorded music to programs on the visual arts and Minnesota history. We serve the underserved by providing programming for those not reached through traditional media like programs in Hmong, Somali, and Spanish, for example. KMSU in St. Cloud has 6 hours of Hispanic Latino programming every Saturday. And we promote civic engagement, media democracy, and equity. As part of our commitment to helping Minnesota, last year all of the AMPR stations worked very closely with the U.S. Census, as well as the State Demographer's Office and Department of Administration, to try to make sure all Minnesotans were counted in the census. We put forth a special effort to reach new immigrants, English language learners, Native Americans, and other believed to be underrepresented in the 2000 census. And you also asked that we identify efficiencies in our agency that we have implemented. I can tell you that as small community radio stations, we've learned to be extremely efficient. We have no choice. While our stations are hyper-local, there are cases where it makes sense to air programs on other AMPR stations or even a handful of stations, but there was no easy way to distribute them. We recently used state funds to create an infrastructure that makes it incredibly easy to share these programs. It also automatically places the programs on the AMPR's website, making them available to all Minnesotans now and in the future for free. When the budget allows, we replace equipment. In broadcasting, older equipment typically means less efficient and requiring more labor, but that's not always the case. Sometimes it makes more sense to repair rather than replace equipment, and we're constantly walking that fine line. But perhaps our biggest cost savings measure is our reliance on volunteers. There are literally hundreds of volunteers across Minnesota who keep these stations on the air. Without them, it's safe to say we would cease to exist. AMPR stations have received community service grants and equipment grants for more than 30 years, dating back to 1980. During that time, the Minnesota State Legislature has recognized the important role of these stations, as well as valuable resources for their communities. These grants provide us with important funds to help us serve our local communities. In several areas, AMPR stations provide the only option for emergency service agencies to get urgent and potentially life-saving information out to the public immediately. Please refer to page 15 of your handout where you'll find a letter from the Cook County Sheriff. This letter talks about an incident last year when Northeast Minnesota lost basically all forms of phone and internet service, and WTIP provided the only outlet for emergency information to the residents of the area. KVSC is the only station in St. Cloud that is staffed 20 of the 24 hours in a day. Having a live employee at our studio rather than relying on automation means KVSC can get information out to the community immediately, about 20 to 30 minutes faster than stations relying on automation. Excuse me. In FY11, AMPRs received $94,000 in equipment grants. That was down 6% from the previous year and comes out to about $8,500 per station. Several of the stations used a portion of the funds to replace their emergency alert systems that warn listeners about imminent tornadoes, storms, and other emergencies, including amber alerts. Some stations that have not already done so are planning to use state equipment grant funding in the next fiscal year to replace their emergency alert systems. This is not an optional expense. FEMA and the FCC have mandated that all stations switch over to a new digital common alerting protocol by September of this year. Two of the stations use the equipment grants to repair, replace, or upgrade their transmitter, improving the station's signal and, in one case, dramatically increasing the station's coverage area. A couple of the stations use the fund to begin or continue to transition from analog to digital, among other things, allowing them to archive more programs to make them more available to Minnesotans as well as future generations. And three of the stations purchased equipment that allows students to learn on emerging technology. In the next biennium, the stations are hoping the state funds will be available to help replace audio boards that are failing after 15 years of use, aging transmitters that date back as far as 1973, and de-icing systems, because ice can force a station to go to low power or even shut down their broadcast. In FY11, AMPRs received $267,900 in community service grants. That was down about 6.5% from the previous year and comes out to roughly $24,300 per station. The state community service block grants literally help to keep our stations on the air. Stations rely on them to pay electric bills and tower rental fees. They also help to support Minnesota's economy. The majority of the stations use some of their community service funding to pay employee salaries. In my case, for example, at Jazz 88, the money helps to provide for most of the salary for one of the two instructors at the station. It's important to point out that 8 of the 11 stations are able to essentially multiply the state grants through the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The CPB grants are based on a formula tied to non-federal support. In other words, when the stations get more money in state grants, they can also get more from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Of course, on the flip side, if the state funding drops, those stations then lose their CPB dollars. As I'm sure all of you know, the Amper stations receive funding from the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, also known as the Legacy Fund. In crafting the language for the Legacy Fund grants, we were very deliberate in making sure that Legacy Fund dollars were used to create new and existing arts and cultural programming for the citizens of Minnesota, rather than going towards general operating expenses. We did so because we felt that was the spirit and intent of the voters when they approved the amendment. And because the amendment prohibits legacy funds from being used as a substitute for existing state funds. Our record has demonstrated since the inception of the state community service and equipment grant programs, Amper stations have been and will continue to be excellent stewards of these funds. Senator Goodwin, on Monday, you asked most agencies testifying to tell you how much they received in legacy funds and how much they will be requesting. Amper's received $2,650,000 in the last biennium. We are still in the process of determining our arts and cultural programming for the next biennium and the funds we would need for them. We realize the severity of the budget crisis facing the state. We also realize that, unfortunately, it's going to be necessary for you to make cuts in order to balance the budget. Obviously, we'd prefer not to deal with budget cuts, especially as we face rising costs. In the event that you find it necessary to make cuts, we ask that you treat us as you would any other worthy recipient of the state's precious resources, ensuring that cuts are reasonable and proportional to other agencies in Minnesota. In conclusion, I'd like to ask you to follow the governor's proposed budget for the Ampers for the next biennium. That would be $278,000 per year for the community service grant. Chairman Perry, members of the committee, this is a correction to the amount listed on page 14 of your handout. The handout reflects the amount the Department of Administration first provided with us. Unfortunately, that number was incorrect. It should be $278,000 and $97,000 for the equipment grant. That, too, is a correction on page 14. The governor is recommending $97,000 per year. That's a total of $375,000 per year to be distributed among the 11 stations. We'd love to ask for more, especially since some stations are literally trying to place duct tape wires with new wires that aren't frayed. But we realize that's not realistic. So we ask that you follow the governor's recommendation. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for your continued support.
Well, thank you very much. In talking about, of course, you're talking to a guy that grew up in the radio world, so when you talk about duct tapes and back in the days when you would go out to do play-by-play of a broadcast game and you'd have a telephone and your equipment go down, you'd take the receiver and take the voice piece out and you clip two wires on and you were broadcasting from a sports event. So I know how you can make radio stations work with duct tape and wires and such. You know, I like what you do. I like the fact that you're educational, and I guess I bring that up because I didn't hear you say, how many students in the course of a year do the stations work with, and, you know, what kind of outcomes are you having with that?
Chairman Perry, I can only speak for my radio station, which is owned by the Minneapolis Public Schools. We serve around 150 students per year. I'd have to get back to you on the other numbers.
All right.
But, Mr. Chairman, I don't have numbers, but the stations that involve students are all the state universities, Mankato, Winona, St. Cloud, the University of Minnesota at the Minneapolis campus and the Duluth campus, and the University of Minnesota Morris is a totally student-operated station. And Thief River Falls is at the Vocational Community College up there. They involve students in the process. KFAI in South Minneapolis involves student interns in their news program. KMOJ, the Black Run station in North Minneapolis, involves students on a regular basis in their programming as well. And Michelle, have I missed any of the ones that?
I think that
would be about it.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Senator Wieger.
Well, Mr. Chair, and actually, I could add one. WTIP, My Cabin's in Grand Marais. And they have students actively involved in different programming spots at the public, at the charter school as well. And I think it adds a lot to reaching out. And if I could just add, they do so many great things at that station. It's literally, as you have the Sheriff Falk letter, when communications broke down, it can be a lifeline. It was during the Ham Lake fire. And just the wide array of community services. This is the way that people can communicate. And a lot of people from the metro and other parts, they go up to that beautiful part of our state, and it's used as a source of information. So I know firsthand about the educational dimension where students are involved in programming at WTIP as well.
And, Mr. Chairman, talking about WTIP and the Ham Lake Fire, before the Ham Lake Fire was the blowdown in the Boundary Waters Canoe area. That set up the Ham Lake Fire, and the potential is still there for other fires. The WTIP received a federal grant to put a translator, that is a repeater station, at the end of the Gunflint Trail. That repeater station is able to cover almost the entire part of the BWCA where canoers and backpackers go. That is the only way that those people enjoying the wilderness area can be alerted to a fire. If you've ever been out in the woods all by yourself, I mean, there is no cell phones don't work out there. I mean, there is that's the only radio contact there is. And so most of the outfitters send radios out with the canoers because that's how they can keep up to speed. WTIP also, because so many people live outside of even telephone lines, they have a message board. If a family emergency comes up, they broadcast it over the air. And I'll guarantee you, like Senator Wieger was saying, people listen to WTIP. It's the only way they can get any news. When a rock slide closes Highway 61, people in Duluth don't know that. And even if they knew it, that didn't make that big deal. But when you get in your car in Grand Marais and drive 3.5 hours and come to a rock slide, you want to know that rock slide's there before you get in your car. And that's another one of those services that WTIP provides.
Can you talk a little bit, where are you at on tax exempt? Are you tax exempt? And if so, what all is exempt?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, all of the AMPR stations are organized under tax exempt organizations. Clearly the ones in the state universities, the University of Minnesota, the community colleges, the school district in Minneapolis, they are all part of a tax exempt government. All the rest are tax-exempt 501c3s. People that contribute to them get tax exemptions. They're qualified for tax exemption from as tax-exempt organizations.
You pay sales tax?
Mr. Chairman, yes, on any of the purchases we make, unless the school makes the purchase, which is not usually the case, but they do, we pay sales tax. All the community-based ones do.
And based on the legacy dollars that you do get, are you able to use those to leverage federal grants or federal money at all?
Chairman Perry, I have used the legacy grants to focus more on partnering with local other nonprofits. I don't know about the other stations. Again, I haven't used them to. I'm trying to think if I have. I haven't used them to leverage federal grants, just to collaborate with other local nonprofits.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I meant to mention this earlier. Most of the AMPR stations are members of the Minnesota Broadcasters Association, and over the years we've enjoyed a fair amount of support from them. They do not see us as competitors. There is no way a commercial broadcaster can put 12 different languages on the air and still make money for their investors. We make return to the community. That's how we bring benefit to our community and doing serving those community. Michelle, in her testimony, talked about the Census Bureau and our work getting the immigrants to fill out the census forms. The people without citizenship still fill out census forms. Minnesota and the United States are home to lots of refugees that our federal government has decided to give refuge to. Most of those people came from countries where the government was the enemy. They don't like to do anything with the government. And we, through our foreign language stations, broadcasts, told them the importance of being counted in our U.S. Census. And for Minnesota, you can't understand how important that was, because it's fairly common knowledge that it was the number of immigrants in Minnesota that were counted that allowed Minnesota to keep its 8th congressional seat. If we would have lost that seat, you proportionally lose that much federal funding. Mm-hmm. Our citizens pay taxes, and federal funding comes back to states in proportion to their congressional delegation. Losing one seat means a lot. And we were happy to be able to play a role with the Census Bureau of convincing the immigrant communities to fill out those census forms, and that plays a huge role.
We had a couple of comments from folks who were concerned about the cost in creating the programs that you create with the legacy dollars, that they felt that some of the production cost of the program were far higher than what the cost would be at a commercial radio station. Do you have any comment on that?
Chairman Perry, I'd have to see the specific examples to really address that in an educated way. I can only state that for me personally, managing the station and being in broadcasting for almost 20 years in commercial and non-commercial stations, I got used to spending very little money on programming, finding ways to get people to donate things to me, and space and pianos and things like that. And having these legacy dollars, I had to turn my head around in order to figure out how much something really does cost to produce when you're putting on a live event that you want to record for later broadcast, things like that. So to me, I've always learned how to spend very little money, and so having this money wasn't just a luxury, it was truly a necessity to really pay for what people are worth. So having said that, I'd have to know about an individual thing to really address it with some education. Can I clarify something?
I don't know, excuse me, but I don't know. Granted, you should be able to give us some idea. You were in the commercial side, and if we have folks saying that they believe the cost that you're spending, the expense to produce the programs, are higher than they normally would be, I would think that you, with your background and the years of service, that you would have some idea if, in fact, you were higher. And it concerned me just a little bit, the statement you just made about paying people for what they're worth. And that could be debated between commercial radio and public radio time and time again. So I just bring it to the forefront that there are some out there that do look closely and that are in the business of producing programs that have brought it forth, that they feel that maybe we're being a little bit too lenient as we get going from the commercial side when we're highly scrutinized by people that own pieces of the pie as opposed to on the public side. So.
Well, Chairman Perry, I'll clarify my comment, paying people for what they're worth as opposed to making them do it for free. That's what we used to do.
Sure.
And, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, all of our budgets for all of the stations under the legacy stuff are a part of the contract we have with the Department of Administration that oversees us. We entered into contractual agreements with with the department administration in each of our 11 stations that qualify for legacy funding, and the budgets are a part of the documents. They're open to the public. We're more than happy to make those, and I'll be more than happy to follow up, Mr. Chairman, to see if we can figure out what's going on and about the discrepancies. Sure.
Any other questions? Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just confused over the dollar amount on the governor's budget and the amount that was printed. Could you explain that one more time, please?
Mr. Tilley. Mr.
Chairman, Senator, I had gotten telephone information about what our dollar amounts were. It was hard to keep track of because we 2 years ago when the legislature approved the budget, first we had an allotment of a part of the monies that went to our stations, and then secondly, last year we got a general reduction in the dollar amounts, and so following the paper trail was hard. So I just got on the phone and called the folks at the department administration who gave me a number that when preparing this document, when we got the actual budget, governor's budget documents and the line item detail, that differed from that number. And so Michelle had just, we wanted to make sure we had the right numbers before you. And we'd sent this document earlier for the earlier meeting and had, did not have a chance to upgrade it.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So is it my understanding that perhaps the governor's budget had more in it than you would have hoped for, and this was maybe a bit of a windfall from what you had hoped for and not a cut like other agencies are expecting?
Well, Mr. Chairman, in my world, the hopes are very large. The governor's never met my hopes for the amount of funding for my public radio stations, but no, I just couldn't follow the dollar amounts because of the way the reductions occurred. So I made a mistake in putting the document together, and I wanted to clarify that.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So then how does that compare with your budget from last year? Would this be an increase?
No,
stay the same?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, no, this is still a decrease.
Thank you.
It reflects both the unallotment of some of our dollars and the general budget reduction we got last year as part of the budget balancing bill.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you very much. Have a great day. Next item on the agenda is an overview of the Chicano Latino Affairs Council. Is there anyone? Yes.
Hey, John.
Please come forward and state your name.
We tabled it.
Hello, Chair Perry and senators, members of the committee. I appreciate your invitation to speak about the Latino Affairs Council. I'm the executive director and started in this position in October of 2009. And we have delivered to you a set of...
Say your name again, sir. For
Hector Garcia.
Thank you very much.
And the documents that have been provided to you are the biennium report that we regularly present to the governor and to the legislators, as well as a workforce and economic development report that had been submitted to your offices previously, but we thought it would be good to give you another copy. And there's also a brochure of the Latino Affairs Council. In terms of your questions, what is your agency mission and how will we accomplish it? By the way, we are, myself and three other staff members, two of whom are here, Gladys Rodriguez in charge of the administrative unit, and David Espinosa in charge of the legislative research unit. There's a fourth person by the name of Astrid Olerenshaw, not a Latino last name. She's married to a gentleman who grew up in Oregon, and she's in charge of our community unit. She's not here today. What our mission is to advise you, the legislature, and the governor's office on matters of importance to the Latino community. There are currently about 208,000 Latinos in the state of Minnesota, spread throughout the state. As a matter of fact, in the biennium report, you can see a map of where the clusters of Latinos are present. We are a community that is made up of a variety of nationalities of origin. Not everyone is an immigrant, but there is a large representation of immigrants in our community. And our ancestors, or we ourselves, like me, come from Mexico, Central America, South America. And this diversity has been growing considerably. Most of us grew up speaking Spanish, some Portuguese, some English, and the communication between the government and the Latino community is vital because, as you probably know, we're the fastest growing ethnic group in the country. And we will become, in some years, the largest minority in the country as well. So this role of advising the legislature and the governor's office on matters of interest to the community is vital from my perspective. And also informing a lot of those Latinos throughout Minnesota about how the government functions in the U.S., particularly is important to those who happen to be immigrants and who come from political environments which are radically different from that which exists here in the United States. There are some who do not speak English well, and recent immigrants sometimes not at all. So communication, as you can well imagine, becomes a very, very important function which the Latino Affairs Council has been performing for over 30 years. Actually, it used to be known as the Spanish-Speaking Affairs Council, and that name has been changed. We also publicize the accomplishments of Latinos in our community. This is very important because it is common when there are minorities in a state and in a nation that sometimes the negative news appear and are read or seen by the majority community. So we like to publicize those achievements, bring to the fore what the Latino community is contributing to the state of Minnesota and to the nation. This has much to do with the work that we have been doing with the Humanities Center, with the Legacy Fund, which I will be addressing in a few minutes. We contribute to the improvement of Minnesota in various ways. I'm sure many of you have gone to Lake Street, for example, and have seen the huge transformation that the Latino culture effected in that area, which previously used to have a high incidence of crime, and now it is a thriving commercial center. You can also see it at District del Sol in the west side of St. Paul, as you can see it in the east side of St. Paul and throughout many areas of the state. One of the fact sheets that we submitted to you points to a dramatic growth in the sales of Latino businesses between 2002 and 2007 of 248%, which is highly impressive. So is the growth in the number of Latino businesses in the state. Our population is growing rapidly between the year 2000 and 2030. It was projected to double from 3 to 6% of the population of the state of Minnesota. We're currently at 4%. Only 1% is what we represent in terms of businesses in the state. So one of the things that we're trying to do is to generate greater growth in the Latino businesses and in Latino employment. You will note that at the end of our biennium report, we commented on the fact that we were working with legislators to try and introduce a bill for job training for Latinos and for other communities, the Asian Pacific community and the Black Minnesotan community. That bill was just introduced by Representative Mullery 2 days ago. I believe the number is House File 645. We've been very aggressive in trying to promote increased employment of Latinos because our unemployment rate is currently 15%, which is more than double that of the state. And it is for various reasons that we have a higher unemployment. It is not because Latinos do not work hard. If you will check out that list of statistics that we submitted to you, you will note that our employment rate is 83%, which is higher than other ethnic groups. I was trying to recall whether that was the exact number or not, but it is in your list. Now, about the change that is feasible in how our agency can operate more effectively and make a greater contribution to the state of Minnesota, I believe, and this is personal, it's something that I have been discussing with the staff and with our board, but which is not official yet, but I believe that this is a time of paradigm shifts. We're going through a serious crisis and have been experiencing it for a couple of years. I come from the financial sector. I used to be vice president of international and domestic emerging markets for Wells Fargo and Mexico Liaison for Prudential-Based Securities. So I'm very aware of the difficulties that the state and the country have been experiencing. And so at a time of crisis such as this, if people do not let fear and anger take over, the great thing about them is that we agree and acknowledge the need to see things differently. And so, for example, CEO Baker from Ecolab just yesterday with Mayor Coleman made a presentation on the Metropolitan Business Plan, which had also been presented to the Senate a while back. And it calls for a paradigm shift in the way the Twin Cities are perceived so that, as they say, Minnesota will not be flown over between the East and the West Coasts. There's also the paradigm shift that's been presented by demographer Gillespie and economist Stinson in the new normal. So it is a time of paradigm shifts, and I believe that it's very important that the paradigm through which the Latino community's interaction with state government and with the majority community be transformed into one that is more of a partnership, In your letter, Chairman Perry, you mentioned working together, accomplishing things together. I think that's the new paradigm that we need to create, is collaboration and partnership. One of the things that I observed in the little over a year that I've been working here was that there was not a sense of partnership between our community and other minority communities and several departments and agencies. Where plans were brought to the table after they were drafted and presented then to our community and to other communities and asking if we would approve them. As I have mentioned to various commissioners, I am mentioning now that we need more of a partnership relationship where we sit at the table to help others draft the plan that is going to have an impact on us. That, to me, is the best way for all of us to work together and to address the many problems that are being faced by the state. Along those lines and in keeping with that idea, I have presented to CEO Baker, to Commissioner Sorrell at the Department of Transportation, to Mayor Coleman, Mayor Ryback, and to Karen Duer from ULI, Kathy Thunheim, Kathy Schmildekoffer, and many others, ideas on how we can help them enhance the Metropolitan Business Plan by incorporating into it the Latino and other minority cultural corridors, so that we can become a vital agent in attracting not only tourism, but attracting investors, attracting trade. Something that is oftentimes missed is the fact that our communities have a tremendous number of contacts in our countries of origin. We know the language, we know the culture, and this is a paradigm shift that companies such as 3M, Cargill, Ecolab, Best Buy, and many others experienced some years ago. So hopefully the state and the majority community will begin to see us as assets in connecting to globalization more effectively. Are there efficiencies in our agency that could be applied to other agencies? Yes, we submitted, along with the other paperwork that we presented, the biennium calendar and action plan, which has been very helpful to our staff and to our board members in carrying out our duties and serving our community. So we hope that it could be useful to other agencies as well. I'll come back now to the funding that was provided through the Legacy Fund to the Humanities Center and the Latino Affairs Council to work together. What we have done also was intended to create this new paradigm. Part of it was dedicated to the absent narratives videos that were filmed by the Humanities Center, which show and will show not only the public at large, but particularly educators and students throughout the state, the contributions that have been made by the Latino community, especially in the Twin Cities. The second part of the program that we've been doing with the Humanities Center was a documentary filmed by Twin Cities Public Television called Latino Arts, a Community Vision, on how our artists viewed the results of the survey we carried out throughout the state, asking Latinos how they believe we could impact the future character and economy of the state. And finally, we interviewed high-level Latino executives at 3M, at Cargill, at Best Buy, Walker Arts Center. A couple of these persons have thousands of people working under them. One of them has a very heavy accent, but that doesn't stop him from being a brilliant contributor to the state and to his company. We are planning now how we will make use of the remaining funds before the end of this fiscal year, and hopefully we will obtain new funds for the next biennium. I believe that covers your questions, but I'll be glad to answer any other questions you, Chair Perry, or other senators might have.
Thank you very much, Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Garcia, I'm looking at the budget, and there's maybe if I three or four questions, if I may, just for clarity. There's a section in there, other benefits for $7,000. I'm trying to get a feel for what that is, because I think the health and retirement are in the 1A and 1B. So what is that?
That item refers primarily, Senator, to the per diems paid to several of our board members. We do have four non-voting members who are legislators, but of the other 11, many of them have to travel here from other parts of the state, one as far as Duluth. So that and the in-state travel pertain to those expenses.
Senator Gazelka.
Chair, that was a second question was related to in-state travel of $10,000. It's line 2G. How many rooms? How often is that? I saw four employees, but you're saying that includes 11.
Yeah, the travel of the board members. As I said, some of them come from as far as Duluth. We have quarterly board meetings, but we have more regular committee meetings, and sometimes we have had, as last January, a special board meeting. So that's the source of those expenses. Our expenses with the staff doing community engagement forums within the Twin Cities and in outstate Minnesota are also a part of it.
Senator Gazelle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Space rental, what are you paying? It's $20,000. Do you know what your per square foot cost is or how big your space is?
Mr. Garcia.
Yes, I'm going to ask Gladys, who knows the numbers better than me. What's the area that we occupy, Gladys? Uh, 1,096 square feet, and there was an effort, as you probably know, in the legislature to assign us to more reasonably cost space, but it failed. The study that was done by the state itself on other locations for our and the other council's offices was attempted. I think that private space might be an option, you know, if it were decided that we're paying too much. As you know, we're currently located where the Secretary of State's office is on 60 Empire Drive in St. Paul. But there was nowhere in the state office buildings that was cheaper. Actually, there were other places, but they were more expensive.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Garcia, with such a small budget, I really appreciate the fact that you were willing to take a cut in your budget. That had to be painful with a small budget like yours. So thank you for that offer.
I appreciate your noticing that.
However, I couldn't fail to notice that the governor didn't take your recommendations and, in fact, decided to give you the same amount that he had last year. Can you comment on that?
Certainly. I would be glad to do so, Senator Carlson. Actually, the governor did assign us a cut of 0.5%, and it was after that recommendation by the governor and the invitation by Senator Perry to testify at this committee that we decided that we could add another 0.5% to the governor's recommendation.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you. But it appears that the governor allotted the same amount as last year and didn't take your recommendation of the 1% cut.
He hasn't seen our recommendation, which was drafted explicitly for this committee's evaluation. His recommendation had been 0.5%, as I said, and we studied that and looked at the consequences to our budget and our activities and felt that for purposes of this meeting that we could add another 0.5%.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you. Thank you for your willingness to help share in the pain.
Thank you.
Any other questions? If not, thank you very much, Mr. Garcia. We appreciate you being here.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for having us. Oh, I see here a note. I apologize, Mr. Chair. That was just laid out before me that PERA actually reduced our rent slightly in our new contract, so it is slightly less than what it used to be.
Thank you, Glass.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The next item on the agenda is an overview of the Council of Indian Affairs. Please, we're running into some time constraints, so not that we want to push you along, but if you could just maybe tweak it up just a notch to get through. Please state your names.
My name is Jolynn Shoptees. I'm the Legislative and Grant Director for the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council.
Could you spell your last name, please, Jolynn?
S-H-O-P as in Peter, T as in Tom, E-E, S as in Sam, E.
And I am Pete Palma with the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council, and I'm with the Cultural Resource Department.
All right, proceed.
First of all, I want to apologize to all of you. Anna Marie Hill is our executive director. She was here but had to leave. She has a very, very sick little boy. He has the flu. So she does send her apologies to all of you. You have two documents in front of you. One of them is this PowerPoint. I'm not going to go through everything. The other document you have is an overview of our language program, and that was a presentation that was given to the Legacy Funding Division. It just has more information about the grants that were given out, and that's more for your information. But if you have any questions on that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have. A little bit about us. We were established in 1963. We are the second such state department created in the United States. And after we were created, many more states decided to follow Minnesota's lead and create a Department of Indian Affairs. Our board, we have a 28-member board. Two things that are not on this PowerPoint is there are two members from the House and two members of the Senate. Our board is made up of all of the 11 tribal nations, their designees, and the commissioners of the state departments that are listed here above. So we do have a 28-member board. We have a very large board, and we meet quarterly throughout the year throughout the state of Minnesota. This is just a map of our Indian reservations. The vision of the Indian Affairs Council is to strive for the social, economic, and political justice for all American Indian people living in the state of Minnesota while embracing our traditional, cultural, and spiritual values. Our mission is to protect sovereignty of the 11 Minnesota tribes and to ensure the well-being of American Indian citizens throughout the state of Minnesota. We have currently a 6-member staff. We have the executive director, Anna Marie Hill. We have our business manager. She's also our OEO tribal specialist. She works almost completely on a federal grant. We have our cultural resource director. His name is Jim Jones, and under him is Pete Palma, which is here with me, and Tom Ross, and they are his cultural resource assistants. And then there's myself, and I'm the legislative grant director and the communications director. In statute, we have 11 duties, and for the purpose of this committee, I only want to focus on two of them, and that would be our official duty number 7 and official duty number 9. We are involved directly in promoting business development and economic development of Indian people in Minnesota. Because we have experienced discrimination in the past and can still experience that today, we play an important role in helping people, Indian and non-Indians alike, come through and succeed despite any discrimination, or in the case of discrimination, help them through education to stop discrimination from taking place. The last official duty on that slide is the official duty. It's number 11. And that is something that came forth about 4 years ago, and that has taken place. It took place a couple weeks ago, and it's happened through this governor and the previous governor, and that's an annual tribal leader summit with the governor. It's been very beneficial, and it's really been a great education experience for the state of Minnesota and for our tribal governments. We have 4 key areas of activity. The first is our legislative and community outreach. During the legislative session, we're over here constantly monitoring bills and updating our tribal nations about what's going on over here. The Language Revitalization Grant Program, which, again, you have a second handout on if you would like to learn more about that. Our Cultural Resources and Reburial Program. This is very, very important. It's actually governed by state statute and federal statute. The federal statute is the Federal Native American Grave Protection and Repatriation Act. And our final is our Office of Economic Opportunity Grant, and that's a federally funded grant that's been in our office for over 20 years. The next slide is our budget information. I'll answer any questions that you have on this that I can't answer, but again, I'm not the executive director and I don't have access to a lot of this information, so I can answer any questions you have, but I may have to defer to a later date if it's specific information. A couple of things that I did want to go over, and I apologize, this isn't very large, is that if you'll notice, between fiscal year 2010 and fiscal year 2011, under the general direct appropriations, we did have a little bit of a carryover. And the reason why we had a carryover is because Pete, our cultural resource specialist, was diagnosed with a near-terminal illness, and we didn't know if he would be able to return or not. And so he was on medical leave. Thankfully, he is now all better, and he is here with us. The other, we were appropriated $1.9 million out of the legacy fund, which was used solely for our grant and our feasibility study, and we had $500,000 that was a pass-through through our office. Out of all of our legacy dollars that we were appropriated, no dollars were given towards administration fees. And so every single penny that we were appropriated to grant out was grant out. We didn't keep any of that. And so that was one thing that we really wanted to do so that we could make sure that the true meaning of the legacy fund was implemented throughout all of our granting. And again, here's just a breakdown of the legacy funding. Just a brief overview about our cultural resource program. I'm not going to read this. But basically, if there's any burial mound that is found, or if you're in your backyard and you're adding on to your house and you find remains, you would probably call the police, number one. The police and the state archaeologist would determine if that was a murder scene. If not, then they can determine if it's an Indian burial site. If it is determined that there are Indian artifacts in there, then our office is the one that comes in and either reburies those artifacts, determines where they should go, and if there are enough artifacts for that to be deemed an Indian burial mound, then it will be deemed an Indian burial mound. And when that becomes an Indian burial mound, there are a bunch of state laws that come into effect with that. Without our office coming in and determining what would happen to those burial mounds, that plot of land would just have to sit there. It can't be touched. And so that's, you know, one of the things that is really key to our office, and we do have 3 employees that are working on that throughout the year. The next slide is looking at how our department contributes to Minnesota. Again, you know, our mandate number 7 and number 9, I think, is really key. In our quarterly board meetings, we do address many issues that come out throughout the year about the Indian people of Minnesota, and I've just highlighted a lot of the issues that we've been working on. In the past, you know, couple years, we've been working on them for as long as I've been working here. We'll be working on them until we can determine solutions for them, and it's not something that we're going to be able to determine overnight. And these are kind of the ways that we have streamlined our work at Indian Affairs. Number one, I don't know if a lot of you will remember, there was the teleconferencing bill last year that enabled all state departments to conduct meetings via teleconferencing, and that was a bill that was started by our department, and it was adopted to all state departments. We do our legislative training every year. It is something that the cost is very minimal, and it has a large impact. This year, we're still waiting to hear back of when the date for our training will be. We have our language revitalization program. Again, we were given no administration fee. We did work very closely with the Office of Grants Management and used their guidance and leadership on what the best way and most cost-effective way would be to implement those grants. We're now using some of our legacy dollars to create the first ever treaties exhibit in Minnesota, and we've partnered with the Minnesota Humanities Commission and the National Museum of the American Indian, which is the Smithsonian in Washington, and that's very exciting, and that will be up and running, I think, by June. We have done a complete overhaul of all of our computers so that we are completely efficient. No staff have any assistance. We don't have any office manager. We do all the work ourselves. We use the Department of Admin, their smart resource team. They do all of our finances. So, again, we don't have anyone in our office doing any finance work as well. And then Pete Palma was going to share a little bit about how we're innovative with our cultural resource program.
Thank you. As far as the cultural resource program goes, we do use the students from Hamline University, and they do a lot of the accessioning of our material that we bring in, which is thousands of pieces depending on the site, and they do an interpretation, and they accession the material, and they get credits in their anthropology. I'm kind of nervous speaking to all of you right now. It's my first week back, so excuse me. We do lectures, and we've worked with the state troopers and doing a familiarization with the Indian society, you know, just kind of familiarized with how they things that their traditions are part of. I have all kinds of things, you know, written here, but there's a lot of work involved in what we do. We work with the local police departments, the BCA, homicide divisions, and the sheriffs of all the counties in the state of Minnesota, and we have a really good working relationship with them, and we try to make it as easy as possible as the transition, depending on the site, for the private landowners or be it the Department of Transportation. And there's just many ways that if you have any questions that you can ask me, I'd appreciate it.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. And that's the end of the PowerPoint.
Mm-hmm. All right. Do we have any questions? Senator Wigger.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Five of us are also on the Education Committee, the Chair, Chair Olson, and I read with great deal of interest your work on K-12, E-12 education curriculum, mm-hmm. testing, and maybe at a future date you might forward us, not only for this committee, but for the Education Committee, your specific recommendations on closing the achievement gap and the graduation rate, what we can do to improve there, and best practices, because I know that you're working on that, and there's not time now to expand on that, but it's a part of your budget, and would like to see that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Wigger, absolutely, yes. I would love to.
Thank you very much for appearing before the committee today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next on the agenda, we have two items left to try to complete here in the next 15 minutes, I believe. Is that correct? Or just one? We have a. All right. If we can work the second item. Okay. The next item on the agenda is an overview of the Asian Pacific Americans Council. Please state your name and you may proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kao Lee Eileen Herr, and I am the Executive Director for the State Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans, and I commonly go by Eileen, so you can call me Eileen. I am here to present on my council's budget and to answer questions that you may have. In the folder that we provided for you, there are three pieces of documents. One is our biennium report, which is statutorily required in November of every other even-numbered year. And a one sheet just showing you the population growth of the Asian American community within the metro and greater Minnesota. And then the PowerPoint presentation that I will go through today about my agency. And so I will start with this document. The first page of the document is just our enabling statute, which covers our mission, which is to advise the governor and members of the legislature on issues pertaining to Asian Pacific Minnesotans, to advocate on issues of importance to the Asian Pacific community, and to act as a broker between the Asian Pacific community and mainstream society. The next page is our organizational chart. We are statutorily organized as an advisory board with a board that is governor appointed that goes through the appointing process or the open appointment process. And all the stuff that are in blue are board stuff. And so we have four committees, an executive committee, a government relations committee, a fundraising committee, and a community relations committee. And then we have a staff of currently, right now, 2.9, myself and another research analyst full-time, and then an office assistant, which works part-time, and a cultural programs coordinator, which is funded by legacy funds to do cultural arts and heritage programming. We have a 0.75 open or vacant position that I hope to fill soon. So the next page is our role as advisors to policymakers, and this goes to answering the question of what is the contribution of the council to the improvement of Minnesota? And the key role in which we were created was to be an advisor to the governor and his cabinet and then to you all. In that, it means that we should be credible and we should be trustworthy. Source of information that you can rely on. So instead of going to a nonprofit to get information on the community, come to us. And I recommend you come to us first because we are state-funded to do exactly this work, and that is the work of knowing our community to provide thorough analysis that is nonpartisan, that serves the best interest of the people that are involved and the state of Minnesota. So in that, we've worked really hard and diligently on economic development and workforce issues. We've worked with Senator Torres-Rae on the achievement gap issue and tried to do many creative things. We've been very instrumental in working with early childhood education in terms of understanding the needs of limited English proficient parents and getting their children ready for kindergarten. We've worked on eliminating health disparities because we want everyone in the state of Minnesota to be healthy and doing well. Issues of public safety and then the arts and cultural heritage. The role of advisors in these areas means that we've offered advice to members of the legislature as you work on these issues and try to understand their impact and importance to the community, and then working with state agencies, looking at their programs, looking at their funding, and looking at how they implement the programs within these areas. So that's our role as advisor. Two is that we are to be an advocate for the community. And because we are to be an advocate for the community, we 100% believe in the potential and capacity of the community to speak about themselves and the needs that they have. So in our role as advocate, we try to do it through three things. One is through advocacy training, and that is to provide opportunity to the community to work with them on the legislative process or the policymaking process, and to creating and empowering their voice, that they have a say within this government. Two is to provide and offer leadership training to emerging leaders, both young adults and to youth. And what this means is that we believe that the community, again, can speak for themselves and can take a part in the decision-making on the issues that affect their lives. So what we want to do is provide training on effective skills and tools for public leadership so that they can take on and be successful in serving the community in which they live in. And then the third thing is that we do realize that there are a lot of organizations in the community, so we want to actually build organizational effectiveness and capacity building of those organizations to serve the needs of the community. So we work with organizations and individuals. The third charge of our mission is to really be a bridge builder between the Asian and non-Asian community. And by that is we want to leverage assets and link the communities, all, of course, to do a public good. And in our role as bridge builder, we strive to, in terms of just examples of us bridging community and government, right now we are currently in a oral history project with the Minnesota Historical Society. There are more than 42 different Asian ethnic groups in the state of Minnesota. They're often little understood and documented. So the question of who are Asian Americans? How did they get to Minnesota? What are they doing well? What are their contributions? What are their challenges? What are their struggles? I myself, besides knowing that I'm Hmong and I came to this country as a war refugee due to the United States' involvement in the Vietnam War, I couldn't tell you when Chinese Americans came to America. I couldn't tell you their history, much less find that type of information. So the challenge for us with these legacy dollars is that let's, for the 25 years, commit ourselves to documenting the stories of Asian Americans, how they came to Minnesota, what are their contributions, challenges, struggles, and successes for future generations. Another example of just the way we bridge community and government and bringing them together to solve real issues is really around the issue of workforce development. And I know this is an important issue to this legislature and particularly this session, and we want to offer our advice to you as much as we can. So please call on us, and we will try to partner with you as much as we can. But an example of this is that there are many, I'll just use the example of Minneapolis. There are many members in the Lao community in Minneapolis that were getting laid off from work, and they didn't have jobs. And they were going to the Workforce Development Center, and because of language skills or because of lack of transferable skills, were finding it very hard to reintegrate and reenter the job market. We had a conversation with Deed and the Minneapolis Workforce Center, and we found that they had no one within their office that spoke Lao that could work with this population, which was significant, about 100-200 people. And that because of these needs, what the direct result of our involvement was that they did hire a couple of Lao-speaking staff, and now the Lao community can come in and get services. And then another example is our work with the Minnesota Department of Transportation around workforce, the hiring of the state's DOT's workforce, and contracting around disadvantaged business enterprises. What we found with DOT is that as their workforce increased in the last couple of years, Asian Pacific Minnesotans within the workforce at DOT has actually decreased. So we're working with them on how to be creative in terms of recruiting, hiring, and retaining workers from the Asian Pacific American community so that opportunities is realized for all. And another way in which we've been bridging between the community and the government is through higher education, through the Minnesota State Colleges and University. In a report, they found that around 75 to 80% of all Asian Pacific Minnesotans high school students chose one of their state colleges and universities and tech institutions to attend. But because of that and the trend of minority students not entering the colleges and universities, there was a real need for them to do outreach to high school students. So we worked with them on a leadership campaign in which youth spoke to other youth about the importance of college and having that as a real choice and a real future. So we partnered with Minsky on that, and that was very successful. We tried to create learning opportunities where information and knowledge can be exchanged among ourselves around Asian American history and contribution to the state. So the highlight of three of them is, of course, our annual commemoration of May as Asian Pacific American Heritage Month with an annual dinner and leadership award, the annual Dragon Festival on Lake Phelan in St. Paul, which is a free two-day arts and cultural festival, and then just currently arts and cultural programming through legacy funds. The next page is just about the Minnesota population. If you could just look and just really see that the community in Minnesota, if you look at the high number, is about 211,000, and then the breakup of the ethnic groups here. And then the last couple of pages is just about what are we going to do with regards to the future. And the board did adopt a strategic plan, five-year strategic plan from January 2009 to December of 2015. And in that are just our goals and some objectives in which we will take on to realize the goals that we have. And then the last questions that I was supposed to answer for your committee is really around arts and cultural heritage funding. And that is not part of our operating budget at all. The funding that we receive for arts and cultural heritage goes to directly to the Minnesota Humanities Center, so that money doesn't flow to the council. And so we work with them on creating the programs. And we have three areas of focus. One is a missing narrative, which is a video project piece. Two is monthly arts and cultural programming that goes directly to the community. And then the third piece is really around capacity building, really getting the community together, and also working with rural communities to talk about what are their cultural preservation issues. And I'll just share with you, we just went to Rochester, Minnesota, and we met with the Cambodian community there, and they said their number one issue is language preservation. Because when they did a survey among their youth, which is about that population down there is about 8,000 in Rochester, Cambodian community, and they said that about all their youth, only 20% spoke the language Khmer or Cambodian at home, and that led to a lot of non-communication between parents' generation who spoke Khmer but didn't speak English, and their children who spoke only English and no Khmer, and how that was leading to a lot of family and intergenerational dysfunction, and how a priority for them would be to preserve the language, and could we help them to do that? And I said, of course, we'll help you to do that. If that's just as little as buying instructional booklets about the Khmer language, we will be more than happy to help you think about language preservation. So that was one of the areas in terms of outreach to Greater Minnesota, finding out the communities out there, what are their priorities, and finding ways in which we can help them to realize their priorities. And with that, I will close my presentation, and then I will answer questions.
Thank you very much. Any questions that we have? Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question on the budget. It's page 11 that says salaries and benefits are a little over $507,000, and I can't figure out how that lines up to the salaries on the other sheet.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Senator Gonzaga, the one that your committee presented is the 2.9, which is reality today. This that you see in the biennium budget report was my old staff. I had some retirement in this summer, and I loved my staff, but we were an old staff in that we've been with the state more than 15 years among each and everyone. I'm the youngest, and I've been there 14 years. And so everyone was old, and so we did have a very top-heavy payroll expense. And with that, with just hiring not just in terms of not younger age, but in terms of work experience with the state, brought in a lot of new people, and that has actually lessened my payroll expenses significantly, which then opens up, of course, opportunities for programming dollars. So what you see here was when I had full four staff with us all being there more than 14 years. And as you can see, that would be significant in terms of retirement salaries. And that also led to what you saw in other benefits of the $20,000. That other benefits was actually the payout to the retiring state employees in terms of their sick and vacation accrual. So that's what led to high expenditures for my agency with regards to payroll.
Okay. Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One last question related to rental space. Do you know what your square footage is there? I know some of the other testifiers, they were at about 20,000. I'm just wondering why yours is that much higher.
Ms. Senator.
Mr. Chair, Senator. We are in the Centennial Office Building, and when we moved to there about 8 years ago, it was a really great deal because at that time, the state's priority was to move all state agencies into state-owned buildings. Since then, when we moved in, it was about, we're at about 1,600 square foot. It was $13, and now it's up to about $20. And so we're a small state agency, and so when you look at the rent, it will seem that we're paying a percentage is higher, but we are in a state building, and that is a priority of the state. And so we love it there. We love being in a state in a state-owned building. That says a lot to our community about our credibility as a state agency doing work with the community and for the community. So that's not really up to us to negotiate because we're there. It's a state building. The price is already set and the maintenance is already set. The option of whether or not it would actually cost us more to move out to a new location because when you think about the moving cost, the build out, all of that stuff, so it works for us right now and we like it there.
Senator Torres Ray.
Just very quickly, Mr. Chair, these agencies, I just happened to work with the agencies, and I was working with the Office of Homeless Person for Families prior to coming here for 7 years. They work with the Department of Administration, and they kind of present the options that exist. And as they kind of, have these contracts, empty buildings, all of these variables that they need to contemplate in order to move these small agencies. And it's kind of an interesting question, I think, and an opportunity to look at how these decisions are being made. Because sometimes issues around parking space and are very complicated for small agencies like this, where they just have, three staff members, and then parking becomes a very tough negotiating piece because they don't have enough people. So they didn't talk about this, but I don't remember ever having a choice as to where I was going to move because they moved us to wherever the state thought it was most convenient for the small agencies. And sometimes they are at a disadvantage because they are so small. Just wanted to
sure. Thank you very much. Out. Any further questions? Yes.
Mr. Chair, Senator Torres Ray, thank you so much for that clarification and for your support in the past many years of working with our councils and our community. I wanted to close with two comments, and one is, of course, I am here to speak in defense of my budget and ask that you go with the governor's recommendation. Very tight and lean budget. We are, that I'm running, keeping it as low as possible to make sure that we can reach out to the community and do as much programming as we can to the community. And then the second part is to just state very clearly that the cultural the legacy amendments dollars that we've received. We so appreciate it, and we so appreciate the partnership that we have developed with the Minnesota Humanities Center, and we hope that that will continue to grow. And that one directly goes to the community in terms of us working directly with the community. And to be honest with you, 100% of the programming goes to the Asian Pacific community. And it touches them, and it allows them an opportunity to then work on cultural and heritage preservation, which I believe is all of Minnesota's cultural heritage. So I appreciate, and I hope that we will all get your support as you continue to think and to prioritize about the budget and also about the legacy dollars. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, committee, next week we will wrap up overviews and explore some of the change items that are coming within the governor's budget. I should remind you we also still have the Council of Black Minnesotans, OET, State Auditor, and the Governor's Office that we will be hearing from. And if there are any other agencies that you feel that you would like to see or hear from, I'd appreciate